Blog Talk Radio.
Everyone, this is Monica Liel welcoming you to the LL Radio program In the Now Q&A with Carla L. Ruckert. Today is March 9th, 2012. Gosh, forget what month it is sometimes. Carla L. Ruckert is an author, mystic, seeker, and primary channel for LL Research. I'll be asking Carla questions that come from you. If you would like to ask Carla a question live on the air, call 646-595-2294 and press the 1 key when prompted. Again, that number is 646-595-2294. Or you can join the chat room on the webpage for In the Now at blogtalkradio.com/LLResearch. When submitting questions, please remember this is a Law of One Q&A. Try to keep your questions as spiritually oriented as possible. Again, I'm Monica Liel, and I'm talking with Carla L. Ruckert of LL Research. We will be here every Friday at 8 p.m. Eastern. Hi, Carla. How was your week?
Hey, Monica. Well, it was kind of interesting. We just about got blown away.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
A little bit north of us and a little bit south of us and a little bit east and west of us all got scrounged with terrible tornadoes, and we were not at all touched. But it was an amazing thing to see pass through the area. Probably a once-in-a-lifetime experience.
Wow. A little too close for comfort, huh?
It was a scary thing, just from the standpoint of extremeness, it was amazing and riveting. You were watching the weather maps with all their incredible colors and showing this and that and the other thing. We had some of the worst tornadoes that ever have been through anywhere came through here.
Wow.
And it was just, Henryville, the whole town is gone. And a little town in Kentucky, Liberty, Kentucky, is just about gone. But it's a wonderful thing to see how everybody's heart opens at a time like that, and both of those places have been just overwhelmed with people donating to the Red Cross, either money or, goods for people that have lost everything in these horrible tornadoes. Anyway, we spent a very pleasant hour down in the basement because it was coming right over the top of us. We had to be careful.
Wow.
And,
well, it's a good thing you had a basement. Does everybody have a basement
over
there?
Yeah, I had a basement, and it was even, really comfortable. They brought me down one of those called Lazy Boys. I don't think the people that usually use them aren't really lazy, but at any rate, it's a recliner. And I was enthroned in that one. That was the best seat in the house. And we all stayed in this little, it's a guest bedroom made out of, clawed out of the walls. I mean, it's really small. There's almost no glass to it at all, no window area. And it's just a basement room. And it was the safest place in the house. So we all hived in there and had a good time.
Do most of the houses over there have basements? Is that pretty standard?
It depends on the part of town. And when the houses were built, in the older part of Louisville, basements were the de rigueur. You always had a basement. But houses that were built right after World War II in the south part of the city, they were building them for people returning home from the war that needed to have a place to live and needed to be a cheap place to live, and so they were cutting corners like crazy, and the whole south side of Louisville has been pumped out of the swamp. At one time it was just a swamp, and now it supports the communities, lots and lots of communities, but of course they tend not to have basements because you know, you dig a basement, you've dug yourself a swimming pool. If the you know, if the water level is that close to you, you just, it won't work. So so yeah, most of the people in this part of town do have basements, and most of the people who own the homes that were built right after World War II, there are just thousands and thousands of them. They're on slabs. And they could have, you know, a basement if they wanted to, because you can't, like I said, you can't dig a basement if you're just going to have a swimming pool.
Right.
You know,
right.
Not going to work. Oh, goodness. Well, at any rate, let's get to the opening riff. I'm
We are glad you're safe, so that's that's the important thing. Okay, the opening riff for today is from session 50.7. Questioner. Can you expand on the concept, which is that it is necessary for an entity during incarnation in the physical as we know it to become polarized or interact properly with other entities, and why this isn't possible in between incarnations when the entity is aware of what he wants to do? Why must he come into an incarnation and lose conscious memory of all that he wants to do and then act in a way in which he hopes to act? I am Ra. Let us give the example of the man who sees all the poker hands. He then knows the game. It is but child's play to gamble, for it is no risk. The other hands are known. The possibilities are known, and the hand will be played correctly, but with no interest. In time-space, and in the true color green density, the hands of all are open to the eye. The thoughts, the feelings, the troubles, all these may be seen. There is no deception and no desire for deception. Thus, much may be accomplished in harmony, but the mind-body-spirit gains little polarity from this interaction. Let us re-examine this metaphor and multiply it into the longest poker game you can imagine, a lifetime. The cards are love, dislike, limitation, unhappiness, pleasure, etc. They are dealt and redealt and redealt continuously. You may, during this incarnation, begin, and we stress begin, to know your own cards. You may begin to find the love within you. You may begin to balance your pleasure, your limitations, etc. However, your only indication of other selves' cards is to look into the eyes. You cannot remember your hand, their hands, perhaps even the rules of this game. This game can only be won by those who lose their cards in the melting influence of love, can only be won by those who lay their pleasures, their limitations, their all upon the table, face up, and say inwardly, all of you players, each other self, whatever your hand, I love you. This is the game, to know, to accept, to forgive, to balance, and to open the self in love. This cannot be done without the forgetting, for it would carry no weight in the life of the mind-body-spirit beingness totality.
Thanks, Monica. I love that quote. And I know it's a long one to read, but I don't actually have as much to comment on about it as I might with some of the shorter quotes, because it expresses so clearly the point that it's trying to make. So much in our lives has to do with the feeling of being smart or being clever or being up with the crowd or being able to handle things well, whatever. And in order for us to go through those interactions in life, often it's a matter of the party of the first part over and opposed to the party of the second part, not because there's any disagreement between the two, but because it's just business and you have to protect yourself in business. And so you slip and you slide through all the masks and all the charades of life, doing the best you can to certainly be positively oriented, to serve others, but hopefully to skin through with one's own needs met and the needs of one's family. There is always that powerful desire to be more clever, to read the cards of others better, to play the game better. And I absolutely love that moment of realization that the way to play the game of spirit is to put the cards all down, face up, and say, here's my hand, here are my cards, let's boogie, and just let that be that. it's such a relief, I think, to realize that you are not responsible for, you know, fill in the blank life. As people try to tell you from early childhood onward, you're responsible for then fill in the blank, and depending on what people expect of you, it can be a harsh thing. But in truth, what people really expect of you is that you will be a person that they would want to know, that you would be a person that relates between himself and another person with that goal towards service to others, with that desire to be a support and a comfort rather than to be clever and to outwit the other person. So let us take a deep breath and reject in this one moment that great pressure that the culture loves to put on us to know the clever thing, the right thing, the smart thing to do. Let us lay our hands down under the melting influence of love.
Is this quote the what gave you the idea for your book?
Which book?
The game, the Law of One 101.
Oh yeah, well,
the choice.
Yes, thinking about it, obviously, thinking about it as if it were a game was not off limits. And the more I asked, queried in that direction, the more I realized that they considered it was a perfectly dandy game, and that we should frame it as such and enjoy it as such. You know, it doesn't to see that it's a game doesn't mean that it's you've taken away all the goodness of it. The fact that it's a game is just slates it into the human activity as catalyst. You know, now some pretty good catalyst going here.
Mm-hmm. Well, I really liked how you explained it as the multi-tiered game, the big game and the little game. Mm-hmm. That really kind of explained a lot. And I'm going to put a little plug in for your book. If anybody doesn't have that book, I highly recommend it. And you can get it at llresearch.org. And it's called The Law of One 101, The Choice. And it's, I'll let you explain what it is, Carla, if you want to just briefly give a little.
I would love to. I had heard all, ever since I channeled the material in 81 through 84, that it needed somebody that was very responsible and would write a commentary on it to kind of pull it all into some sort of sense. Because the nature of the raw sessions was of necessity spontaneous. The questioner, would think up questions ahead of time and so forth, but he might not get two questions into a session before the raw group said something that was totally amazing to him, and he had to follow up on that, and there went all of his notes. So there's a certain amount of hithering and froing, you know, where are we going? Okay, now we're back here, now we're looking at pyramids. Okay, now we're, you know, it's just, you know, it isn't logical. It isn't made easy in any way, shape, or form. It's just, there it is, blap. A conversation, and you know, the probably the best conversation I could possibly think of. But at any rate, I figured that it would be probably a good thing for me to do to sort of pull it into what I saw as being a coordinated cosmology. It's a type of philosophy that the Ra group offers. It's not anything, you know, dogmatic or religious about it, but it has a lot in common with a lot of the people that write philosophy, especially people that write in metaphysics and cosmology. It contains a lot of the same type of information. So that's the Ra group. And I found that I could see a flow to the material and clean it up to the really the basic things. And of course, I touched very lightly on some of the more advanced stuff. And hopefully, we'll be able to go back in 102, which is a more intensive look at the lower chakra work that we do in a lifetime. And then 103 is going to be the inner work, working with the upper chakras in more detail, in more intensity. I certainly hope I'll get there. I'm not. I've been delayed for a couple of years, so it was kind of a surprise to me. And I'm still galloping for all I'm worth to get back. But at any rate, 101 is a good start on that. Mm-hmm. And if you want to do the principles of Law of One, you can read the book. As a matter of fact, you can even take a course. I help you out, 12 hours of talking in the course, just pulling you through the Law of One material as I see it. And that's with the International Metaphysical University. I think it's imu.edu or something like that. Anyway, I think that book has seemed to be a good resource for some few people. They've written very kind things about it. And yeah, if you think that it might be useful for you, by all means, jump on it.
Well, you've distilled the practicality and the applications of the philosophy of the Law of One, how we can apply it to our everyday lives and in our spiritual journey. And, you know, there's a whole lot of other stuff in the Law of One, like, you know, about the pyramids and all that kind of stuff. It's all very, very interesting. I mean, very fascinating. But to me, where your book really shines is in bringing that philosophy into everyday life. You know, how do we apply this stuff? And I think it's serving a very good purpose there.
Well, thanks a lot.
Great. Well, we have a live caller that I'm going to invite onto the show here. Hi, are you with us?
Yeah, hi, Monica. It's Neral. How are you?
Oh, hey, Neral. I'm great. How are you doing?
Okay, my dear. How doing fine. Hi, caller. How are you?
Hi there. I'm doing fine, too.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. I saw the tornadoes last week. I live in just on the outskirts of New York City, and, you know, I'm looking at the news, and it says it's in, I think, right next door to you in Indiana. And I said, wait a second. Isn't Indiana close to Kentucky? And I said, wait a second,
can't
you know, and then there was,
you.
You know, and, you know, so immediately, you know, it's like, oh, man, you know, and I started praying for you that everything would be okay. And, you know, I mean, those poor people, it happened in Joplin, Missouri, right? I mean, where that town was basically devastated. And here in New York, we had something, let me tell you a little story here. I bought a car, right? Brand new car. The first day I had it, 1 hour, I'm driving into hail, right? So I said, okay, no problem, you know. So we get to the house. By the time we get to the house, and my car is an hour old, the hail is the size of golf balls, okay? And it is coming down relentlessly, and it destroys my car, destroys the roof on the house, and destroys my wife's car. Now, my car is an hour old, okay? The total damage was about $25,000, okay? You know, and I'm looking, and there really was nothing you could do, you know? But, you know what I said to myself? You know what? These are the things that we go through in life, and you can't predict it, you don't know it, and you just have to be thankful, because we all live by the grace of God. We all live by the grace of God, and we don't know. And, you know, one day it is going to be our time to depart this earth. We don't know when, you know, and that really is up to God. But, you know, I look at it that whatever happens, and we don't know, and I guess that's part of the excitement and the adventure of living on this planet, mm-hmm. it's like so long as I live in my integrity as a human being, it really doesn't matter what happens to me, you know? It's like if I know that I am true to myself, that I am living a life that doesn't have any guile in it, what difference does it make, you know?
It's, that's right.
Right? I mean, you know, if I know I did my best and I was sincere in that, if you cut Narelle in half or in four pieces and you looked at him and all four pieces looked the same, it's like there wasn't something on the outside that was different than what's on the inside, then I think I lived my life successfully, you know. But, I mean, definitely we don't know, you know, and I guess it's all part of the earth changes, you know, who knows, you know, but definitely things have changed, you know, but I'm very happy that nothing happened to you guys. But I did have a question that's been on my mind for a while, okay, that I wanted to broach to you. And I'm reading The Wanderer's Handbook, which I absolutely love. It's a great book. And on page 71, you talk about pride and surrender, which I think kind of fits in with what you said before. And I'll just read this to you. It says, as long as you think you have a self that you need to defend, you shall be working with spiritual pride. And so entities, for the most part, are working with this, no matter how persistently and purely and devotionally they have sought year after year. Yet still there is a sense of, I am searching, I am looking, I am seeking to become the best that I can. And then later on it goes, the final goal of all those, of all these true spiritual paths is humility and a willingness to surrender that clay, the pride, the arrogance, the unworthiness, and fear, to surrender all these emotions utterly to the power and peace of knowing that you are love. And let me just add one thing to that, is which I notice a lot in this world, because we're very competitive in this country, is we seem to have a tremendous need to win, and we bait each other, you know. And this way we, you know, and if you respond to that bait, you get sucked into the energy. You get pulled out of your peace, and you get drawn into this, like, whirlwind. And it never stops because nobody wants to surrender. So I kind of wanted to ask you your thoughts about that, and I'll hang up and I'll listen on the internet. Okay?
Okay.
You can still stay on if you like. You don't have to hang up.
Okay, fine.
It's up to you.
Okay.
Thoughts on things happening to people, thoughts on tornadoes, thoughts on fairness, thoughts on the amazing thing that is life. Yes, indeed. I was very, very much at peace in my basement room doing a double acrostics puzzle and thinking, well, I'll put that last little answer in and have the puzzle solved, and then maybe I'll go on to behold another puzzle, and that would be what I do next. But I was enjoying the whole thing. I was very much enjoying the whole process, and it was almost like having a party. I remember in 1974 we had a tornado of this magnitude come through and lost a lot of 200-year-old trees. Kentucky has a very enviable park system, and Louisville is premier among the cities for having lots and lots of park space that has been dedicated for over 200 years now, and went right through the oldest part of Cherokee Park and ripped just, you know, virgin woods apart. But at any rate, I was right by Cherokee Park at that time,
mm-hmm.
and it was very simple. Don and I just emptied out the freezer and the refrigerator and cooked everything because I had a gas stove. And I called everybody I knew and I said, come and get it before it spoils.
Right.
We didn't have any power for days after that. But
right.
I think that the great thing to do in times of inconvenience and great tragedy like these is to cling ever more to the peace that passes all understanding, that awareness that all is well and all will be well. And the more that it doesn't look like that, the more you need that awareness to come from deep within. So I think that for all of us who want to make a difference in these days of a lot of fear and a lot of extreme weather and extreme other events as well,
mm-hmm.
the thing more than anything is to live within the self in a way where you're really living a joyful life, and you're tuning up into the values of positive polarity, service to others, finding the highest and best ways to do things, just because you like vibrating at that particular vibration suits you, you know. And it's as simple as that. The choice that the book I wrote, 101, The Choice,
mm-hmm.
is a choice of polarity. So this is a time among others, of course, but more than any, probably, as we cross over this 2012 timeline that brings a whole new energy into play, that, you know, it's time to settle into the most self-assured, peaceful feeling that you could possibly offer people, so that there is no calm but just light where you are. And it's a gift to give the planet now, you know, more than ever. So that would be what I would think about how to behave during times of crisis.
Right. Well, I noticed one thing that I've noticed about myself lately, you know, is that I seem to be sinking deeper into myself, okay? And what I mean is that, yes, external events exist. And, you know, I'm a person, I really don't like injustice, and I never have. You know, I can remember as a kid watching stories about Haiti and that poor country and the civil rights movement, and, you know, it just bothered me, you know, and these injustices, they exist in different ways today. You know, there's a lot of financial manipulation. There's a lot of stuff that goes on. But I think what I've kind of realized, I noticed after November 11th, for whatever reason, things changed for me to some extent. And I kind of realized that, like you say, if I stay in that peace, okay, and I kind of let go, and let God take care of a lot of these things, which I don't really have any control over anywhere. I can't control Congress. You know, I can call Congress if I'm unhappy, but I can't control a lot of the votes or a lot of the things that go on there. But I can be myself, you know, and I think one thing I've got from your teaching and your channeling and what you've brought is that one of the things that we as wanderers came here to be, we came here, our most important mission is to be ourselves, you know?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And so that's, you know, that's where I'm at right now. And it feels good, you know, because I've let go of the need to assert my energy in a sense. You know, it's like I see things, you know, and before I would like get involved in, you know, and now it's like I'm content to stay within myself and let it develop and you know, and let's see where God takes it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, right, you know, so it feels good. You know, I just feel more at peace living like this, you know, and your writings have certainly had a big impact, and the community has certainly have a big impact on me because it's a refuge, you know, it's a refuge from, it's a place where people understand what I'm talking about, you know.
Yes, yes.
So.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Narelle,
okay.
Thanks so much for calling in. We
thank
love you.
You.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Have a nice evening. I'll continue to listen. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay. And the community that Narelle is referring to is our forum community at bringforth.org. That's bring the number 4th.org. We invite you to check it out. There's chat rooms and discussions, and you can download the books and all kinds of cool stuff there. That's bringforth.org. If you'd like to call and get on the show live, you can dial 646-595-2294. That's 646-595-2294. 1-800-595-2294. Be sure to hit the 1 key if you would like to ask a question live on the air for Carla. I'm going to go to the next question submitted at the bringforth.org community. This is from Ansel. Ansel says, my question concerns the choice of whether to be or not to be. We know our eternal Father, creator of all that is, cause of all causes, changes not forever and is perfect. I believe Ra and Kuo speak of choice mostly in terms of STS and STO opportunities. Is not the ultimate choice between remaining within this prison cage of mind to serve others who suffer, or to fly free of this cage entirely and return to our Father's changeless kingdom? If we chose the latter, would not this then be the ultimate STS choice? I perceive that within the mind-made worlds of illusion, the only constant is change, and that this mind is fearful of the concept of eternal changelessness, perfection notwithstanding. Have Ra or Kuo addressed this prospect of an ultimate choice between serving in the illusory worlds of change and awakening into eternal changelessness? Perhaps the whole plan for mind is to awaken very, very slowly into higher and higher dimensions of understanding until it is ready to know that it never really truly existed in reality to begin with. Carla, do you have any knowing or intuiting of the heart on this issue? Thank you for your kind, compassionate service from Ansel in Texas.
Well, Ansel, I looked at that and I thought, well, how tidy. you created a seemingly seamless series of logical statements which, when gazed at carefully, fall apart completely, and that maybe it'll help if I go through that, help you with this. We don't know that our Father is eternal or that He created all that there is. We can create of ourselves and describe a creator that would do those things. In point of fact, I think one of the things that we know the least about is the nature of the creator. Because there's too much of us involved in wanting the creator to be a certain way. So I would prefer to say I feel, without anything to back it up, that I am an eternal being. And I feel that I'm one with all other things, including one with the Creator. And since you can't have anything of number except the number one in a unity, I can assume that we must be eternal, because otherwise there would be some limit there, and there is no limit. But we truly don't know, and it's dangerous to say, well, we know that the Creator is eternal. How much do you need the Creator to be eternal? How much is it important to your ethic, to your integrity, to suppose the Creator is a certain way? Okay, you talk about the mind-made worlds of illusion, and you play with them beautifully. However, although the image of flying free that you use in talking about escaping from this prison cage of mind is flying free to go to the Father's changeless kingdom, and how would that work exactly? Because we are here, if the Confederation philosophy is correct, because the Creator wanted to know more about itself, which means that the Creator is anything but changeless. The Creator is always seeking to know more, has a hunger for a fuller understanding, which, of course, brings you right back to the primal paradox, which is that you can know nothing. I do love philosophy. Okay, I'm getting serious now. To be or not to be, this is important stuff. I think the plan is indeed to awaken, and maybe sometimes really slowly. There, I think you've got hold of something good. There is fertile soil. Dig away. And certainly, as we awaken, you could say we're awakening to higher realms of understanding. Although I sometimes wonder about that, because a lot of religious and spiritual and mythical fact-finding is a lot like gossip, you know. So-and-so did this and this to so-and-so, and it's all very anecdotal and all sort of all falls apart. If you're trying to make it be literal, it doesn't work. But at any rate, I think that we do indeed awaken, and as we awaken into higher understandings, we continually find that the world is a simpler place than we thought it, and that we really did have the right of it all those times that people laughed at us for being so idealistic. No, we're right. Hold to it, folks. This is the right solution. Love others and serve others. Support others. This is the way it goes. Thanks, Ansel, for that question about to be or not to be. I think it's tremendously important to pick up these questions. I also think it's a tremendously important thing to do, to allow the mind to become absurd to itself. Otherwise, you've just got this big, cranking old mind trying to put one rationale over another on the part of you that likes words and words that position and words that impress and so forth. I love words too, and every time I write, it's a, you know, you're asking yourself, do I really need that adjective, or is that overspending? But yeah, good luck with your questions. They're coming from a really wonderful place, and I really enjoy I enjoyed being with your energy and working with it. Thanks so much, Ansel.
Well, I'm glad. I'm sure Ansel will be happy to hear that you're enjoying his questions, because he has another question.
Ah.
Or maybe, yeah. Okay, here's his second question. I am not really clear on exactly what my soul is or its true relationship with spirit and the Creator. Heck, I'm not even clear on a for real definition of spirit or soul. I do believe humankind could benefit immensely from a better understanding of the nature of self and self with a capital S. When I consider all the time wasted by intellect's focus upon nonsensical trivia, knowing more about the purpose and destiny of the human soul seems very worthwhile, as long as we keep our hearts focused upon the prize.
Well, that is certainly so. I pondered this. I had this actually ahead of time. Monica was kind enough to send this to me on sale. And I just thought to myself, now, where would I want to go in the archive material to work with on sale on this concept? And I found that the resource that I liked the best was La Twee's channeling in February 26, 1989. The opening question of this session was the soul is the essence of remembrance. What is the meaning behind that phrase? I'll read it again because it's out of the left field here. Okay, good. We're orient here. The soul is the essence of remembrance. I don't know who said it. I Googled it, but I didn't find a source for that quote. But at any rate, whoever asked the question, that was the question. So, first of all, once we take up the soul, let us define that which is called the soul as that portion of your being which is imperishable, that portion of your being which was before your world was formed, which was before earth and sky appeared, and which shall be when all that you know now has become naught. This imperishable being, which is earned as an unique consciousness, your soul, is at all times a gift to the Creator from the active principle of creation, which is curious, which learns and which goes through a process called remembrance. Then, because the question was the soul is the essence of remembrance, he takes up essence. Let us gaze at the word essence. That which is an essence is not that which meets the eye. It is not that which is usually particularly easy to determine from intergroup acquaintances with an individual among your peoples. For part of your illusion is the veil which has been dropped between the conscious and unconscious mind. For by rendering your inborn capacity to communicate by concept and thought useless, you are forced to communicate with words and point thus constantly away from the essence of yourself, which lies far too deep for words. And then, of course, having talked about the soul being the essence of remembrance, he picks up remembrance. One's memories have no chance of being objective at any time. They are biased from the beginning, and as your memory becomes older and dimmer, it moves through one of two simple processes. Either it is gilded with a loving hand to emphasize its beauty, its depth of meaning, its poignancy, and its truth, or it is simply blocked and segregated as that which seems too self-destructive to allow within memory or to be healed at that particular moment in space and time. I recommend a thoughtful reading of this session because I found so much good energy in it that lay beyond the grip of the words themselves. I think this was coming from a very deep place, this reading, and it may be something that can move beyond the words and help more than a little bit more than most words can. Again, that let's see. Now I've shuffled it away, and I'm not telling you. Here we are. It's February 26, 1989,
Latwee.
So.
And you can find that.
Yeah, he can find that. I think that basically, he's basically saying, you know, what is my soul? And what is its relationship with spirit and with the Creator? And it's one of those questions that is difficult to talk about in words because the words are inadequate to the task. What is a spirit? What are we? You know, we are everything. So it's the kind of question that is fundamentally important. And it's also the kind of question that quickly goes beyond words. So you're in the process of spiritual seeking and paradox and mystery, and you know you've hit pay dirt when you get there. We can simply say, I think from looking at the Law of One material, that that we are one, that we are aspects of the whole, and that the whole is not complete without all of us. So, do we have time for another question?
We do, and just wanted to let everyone know that they can read that full transcript at llresearch.org, and all of the material is available there for download. And we have a question from Diana, Diana says, I would like to follow up from last week's radio show, actually a couple of weeks back, on my inquiries about channeling. First, thank you for your insights thus far, Carla. Since the first question on channeling was addressed in the show a couple of weeks back, I have been coming across posts and comments both in and outside of the Bring Forth community. The subject seems to want addressing. In last week's show, you mentioned that you could teach how to channel and, more importantly, how to be a good channel. I'm associated with two people, one female, one male, who are very interested in doing this with me. I would not be the channel necessarily. We would appreciate your valuable insights regarding how to proceed. Our intent would be to channel from the highest source possible regarding universal subjects rather than personal.
Okay. First of all, who is the name of this person is Diana, right?
Yes. Diana.
First of all, Diana, several times in the last several years I have formally gone through teaching channeling to those that come to L&L Research for that. I am not now contemplating any kind of a channeling circle soon because of the fact that I'm doing my best to recover from an illness that really doesn't want to cooperate. So I've been bedbound for a while now. And I just won't be able to be there for people to be a teacher. That's kind of a strenuous amount of work. And right now I'm just trying to get over lumbar spine surgery, which isn't all that easy sometimes. So, short of your being able to come with your friends and go through my teaching of that class, I would say that you're probably best off using the curriculum. I put the full curriculum, including one taping of each lesson. So it's not just that there's a book called The Channeling Handbook that I've written, which is I use for a go-to book in when I'm teaching it. And, you know, we cover the points that are brought up in chapter, you know, fill in the blank in a channeling handbook in any one particular class. So all you'd have to do to study it yourself is to read that stuff together and discuss it thoroughly among yourselves. The problem, as you already picked up, is in controlling the psychic event to the extent that you are saved from some of the difficulties that quite typically strike channels. You know that if a question isn't going to be just as important in 10,000 years as it is now, you really probably shouldn't ask it. You've gotten that. And you realize that you can't, you know, go into all the personal specificities for people and give them readings on whether they should buy a stock or bet on the pony or whatever. Don't do that. But there are so many ways to be less than entirely, you know, on the beam in working to channel well. And what I focus on for people, therefore, isn't just to teach a person how to channel. Usually, if a person has a desire to do that, there's some gift involved and is already doing it to some extent. The challenge is in challenging people to do a good job of it. In order to do a good job of channeling, you have to live a life, the life that is recommended by your channeling. You've got to walk the talk. You can't talk about wonderful things of spiritual nature and continue to repeat mistakes time after time, mistakes of kindness, mistakes of humility, and so forth. It's vastly important for a channel of positively oriented material that his or her life be offered as a gift in that service. And the ego left completely at the door, so that there is no nothing holding you back from being entirely empty and being able to move from your absolute essence in tuning yourself to your highest and best, and locating a channel that vibrates at that highest and best. That the joy of this service is incredibly keen, but you have to pay by living an entire life that is one with the material that you're handling as a channel. You really need to be able to say, yes, not only do I channel that, but I also live by it. If I can help you in any way, let me know. But I imagine the best thing I can do for you, Diana, and your little group, is to put you on to the, I think it's in our meetings, the meetings of LNL Research, there have been several channeling intensives. And if you go to the first channeling intensive, those were the lessons that I recorded and got transcribed so that you could actually read what I read. You can read the content without having to pay for it. So be my guest to do that. The archive site is llresearch.org. And you just click on meetings and gatherings, and you'll find the channeling intensives.
Okay, on that topic, and we just have a few minutes left, just the other day, a young friend of mine was mentioning that she had read the Seth material and had just started reading The Law of One, and this is just her second experience with any sort of channeled information. And so she was asking me about the trance channeling, or why you had to go to all this, you know, have everything aligned just right and all this stuff. And I said, oh, it's because it was trance channeled and it was on a very narrow band transmission. And she said, oh, but that, you know, this other person that had written the Seth material, Jane Roberts, had also done trance channeling and didn't have to do all that stuff. So this was coming, and I didn't really know how to answer that question. So since we're on that subject, maybe you could address her question.
Sure. Well, I think that if you wanted to find 100 psychics that do trance channeling in America today, the one that did it poorest is me. I wasn't very good at it. I never learned how to do it in any proper way. I was never trained. And I burned up the exoplasm from within my body rather than allowing it to come through me. So I lost down to about 80 pounds, and eating as much as I could,
wow.
I think I got myself up to 85 a couple of times. That was about it. Until
Whoa.
I stopped doing the trans-channeling, I would lose 2 or 3 pounds every time I had a session. And people would say, well, what a wonderful way to lose weight. And no, it's not, you know, because you're not in control of it. When it goes below 100 and then it goes below 90, you're thinking, oh, dear. But
yeah.
I have no reason to brag about what it had to be done in order to get me in the right you know, vibration to run the raw vibration. I'm lucky I could do it at all. I'm very grateful that it was possible. And it was just a shame how much it took out of me to do that, but it was certainly worth it. You know, I don't regret anything at all. I would have gladly died if I could have just seen Don have that look on his face. He was never saw Don happier, the questioner in the Ra contact, happier than during that conversation with those of Ra. Finally, he said, finally, I'm talking to somebody who knows something. It was great. It was lovely to see that.
So you don't think it's necessarily, of course, I confess I haven't read the channeling handbook because I'm not doing any channeling myself. But,
right, right.
So it's not necessarily necessary that every person that's doing channeling would have to go to the sort of things, you know, do the sort of things that you did as far as the alignments and all
not
that.
Not at all. I would say stay away from it. If it's going to take that much out of you, just don't even go there. You know.
Mm.
At the same time, I'm delighted that I was able to do it, you know.
Okay.
But I could never say, no, this is an example of beautiful channeling here. This is an example of somebody that did not know how to trans-channel and somehow managed to do it anyway.
Wow. Well, that's blowing my mind. I always thought it was because it was a narrow band transmission. That was why. So.
Well, that's why. That's why. That's why they had to move me down into a trance situation.
Mm-hmm.
Was because it was too narrow band. My human variousness, the speed of my mind, I have a very sort of, you've probably noticed it dances around here and there. And trying to hold it down, you know, so that I could get the nuances of what they were saying apparently was impossible without the trance. So into trance I must needs go.
Hmm.
But the conscious channeling that I do from those of Kuo and Hatan and so forth, you can see the difference. You can see the good part of doing the channeling from the trance state because they're able to be much more accurate.
So for the benefit of those who might be wondering, and I'm sure there are people wondering as they listen to this, can you define narrowband transmission?
Well, I think that it probably has to do with the energy of light itself. You know, in third density light, you know, you had the kind of marine base, density of the choice, you know, slugum, you know, it's just a tough, tough kind of light, you know, very broadband, very tough, very there. You get into fourth density light and you're getting to be a slightly narrower band. It doesn't vibrate except among some of the more choice vibrations of love. Okay, you've narrowed that. You get into fifth density, which is a density of wisdom, and you've got a narrower band still because you're filtering for love, you're filtering for wisdom. And then, of course, in sixth density, the light changes again. There's another quantum change in the light, and it's the density of unity. And I gather that density of unity is in terms of a narrow band contact, that would be the most narrow band that you would get. Because in seventh density, they're not turning their face back towards those that came before. They're looking forward to those that will come after. So sixth density is probably the narrowest band that we could pick up as human beings. And I don't define it exactly. I just say that the light changes as you go from density to density, and in the higher densities, it truly does have a tremendous focus.
Okay. We are actually out of time. Thank you, Carla. And to our listeners, you have been listening to LL Research's In the Now with Carla L. Ruckert, and I'm your host, Monica Liel. Please visit our website, llresearch.org, and the other, bringforth.org. Thanks so much for listening. You can submit questions on the bringforth.org website, and we are here every Friday at 8 o'clock p.m. Eastern. We'll see you next week, Friday, March 16th.